This is Polly Young Eisendrath, March 10th and 11th, 2000, What Women Really Want, tape 4 of 4.
I think it would be better
to watch this, to get the thing on the video, because we have two examples of the same couple where...
Yeah, that's true.
I could just explain for a moment, because I think it will do better than we could do in a role play. Because it'd be more real. Although we could do it, but I'm just not sure it's worth as much as it would take for us to do it on something real. We don't like role plays, we have to do it on something real. Which I don't know if it's worth the amount of time it would take to explain it. But on this particular video, there is a couple that, where part of the problem is that the woman is not able or is not willing to get angry and to say what she thinks in a direct way. She's actually angry with her husband, but she doesn't say it. So it makes things very confusing. And he's very confused, and she's very confused. And in the initial one, Polly encourages her to, or sort of helps her to see that it's reasonable that she would be angry about this. And with Polly's help, she does begin to express this in the interview with Polly, and then we shift to a situation where we put her and her husband in dialogue, and then she tries to say what she has to say with him. And again, in terms of any of these videos, this is not a perfect situation, but I think you can
see
sense
it there.
This process of coming out, saying what you think, and looking at the defensive reactions from the other person.
It's a good example. And I just realized how late it actually is, and so we probably need to also get into the nitty-gritty of what dialogue is. So anger and aggression, pretty clear about what it is, and we can maybe come back with some discussion at the end. Now, just in terms of dialogue and dialogue therapy, do you want to do the overview of what it consists of, or do you want to do that?
Dialogue therapy is a method that Polly and I have been, well, we developed it, and it is something we've been doing for about 18 years, as long as we've been together. It's a blend of theoretically Jungian psychology and object relations theory, also some psychodrama techniques. It is the two of us as a couple working with another couple. We have a particular set a setup for the way we do this, which involves chairs set up in such a way that the couple are facing one another and chairs opposite. You'll see it demonstrated in the video. I am sitting slightly behind and slightly to one side of the male partner, and Polly's sitting slightly behind to one side of the woman. Now, if it's a gay or lesbian couple, it doesn't really matter. We just
take our seats.
But we do find that the working with the same gender feels more comfortable for us and for the people we're working with. Basically, we have, as Polly explained earlier, we do six sessions. And then six sessions spaced 1 month apart. The sessions are 2 hours each, except for the initial evaluation session, which is 3 hours.
Let me say briefly what's in that in the evaluation, just the quick overview, just so you can see how we come into this, because it takes a lot of evaluation in the sense we're mapping people's complexes before we go into doing dialogue therapy with them. The very first situation, when the couple comes in, the chairs are face-to-face. We ask them to sit face-to-face. We're sitting outside of their visual field. This looks a little weird. They expected to talk to a therapist. Usually we've sent them a brochure explaining what this is. We say it's a very structured form of therapy and that today this is an assessment and we're going to assess you in different ways. The first thing we would like you to do is to talk with each other about your reason for being here. And so we have them engage with each other while we are listening rather than reporting on each other, or usually we're going to report on the other person, particularly to the therapist. So the very first task is to talk with each other about your reason for being here, and we say, you may have talked about this already, or you may not have talked about it at all. Do not try to inform us of the particulars right now. Try to talk as though we weren't here. And of course we are, but so people will begin. And I won't go through all the different ways we listen to that beginning, but the beginning is extremely important. Then after that very first little dance is out there, we stop them often very quickly after 3 or 4 minutes. And then Ed and I talk with each other. And usually we will ask questions like, one of us will say, well, what did you hear? Or what do you think might be going on here? And we're making a very big guess, but also we're demonstrating talking to each other. We're going to be interested in each other and so on, some of the things that we will later ask them to do. Then we usually decide to do this written format, which is 6 questions.
We give them a pad of paper and a pencil, a pen, and we ask them 6 questions. The questions are, on a scale from 1 to 10, how would you rate the value?
0 to 10.
How would you rate the value of this relationship to you personally? Where 0 is you could take it or leave it. 10 is it's as valuable as oxygen, you couldn't live without. And we don't give them any further instructions. And if they say, well, what did you mean? They'll say, whatever you think, however you want to think about it, you know, give it a numerical rating. And the second question is, what do you consider to be the greatest problem in the relationship? Third question is, what do you consider to be the greatest benefit or benefits of the relationship? Many couples have a hard time answering that because they're so focused on the problems that they have trouble knowing why are they staying in? What are the benefits? The fourth question is, how do you think your partner answered the first question? In other words, how do you think your partner rated the value of the relationship? And the fifth question is, what do you think your partner considers to be the greatest benefit of this? This takes 5 to 10 minutes. And then we, Polly and I, look at them, and if there's something that jumps out, which generally there is, often it's their way of understanding the problem. But sometimes someone doesn't put anything down for a benefit. That's obviously a pretty big sign. And we have them talk to one another about their responses to the questions.
Also, if you see a rating under 4 and under for the value of the relationship, it's not a good sign at this stage. So usually if we see very low ratings, we know ourselves that there's a big problem in terms of the projective identification system, as well as perhaps in terms of betrayal, which is a whole other element of betrayal of trust in the relationship, particularly in infidelity. Yeah, generally speaking it is, yeah. Because, you know, people want to be socially desirable. They want to sort of put the best face forward. So if anything, they tend to overestimate their valuing of the relationship.
But you never, it's really tricky. Sometimes people will put an 8 or a 9 or a 10, and they have enormous problems.
Yeah.
But they're in denial about them. They're so...
But still, they're doing what I would look as a better sign. Now, if any of you come to see us in dialogue therapy, you'll know this, see, in advance. Then after we do this written thing, we'll have them talk about some aspect of it, just again to hear them talk to each other. After we've heard them, we've heard them now in 2 little interchanges, then Ed and I will talk. We'll get a little bit of an overview.
Make a decision about who's going to interview the other person first, whichever seems better to the two of us. Let's say Polly interviews the woman first. And what we'll proceed will be about an hour-long interview. It'll be a relational history.
And I switch chairs.
She switches chairs so that Polly's sitting right here. I'm sitting slightly in back with Polly taking notes from her interview. Polly's talking to the woman, and behind the woman, slightly to one side, is the woman's husband. So he's listening, can't interrupt, just Polly and the woman for an hour. And it's a relational history starting with the present, working back to the past, starting with the current situation, and then the present relationship, what's going on at this moment, history of their relationship, how they meet, why did you fall in love, what you were attracted to, what happened, what developed with whatever problems there were. Going back to previous marriages, if there were any, or previous serious relationships, and then going back to the family of origin history.
In the family of origin history, what we're trying to do is to get a picture of complexes. So what I usually do when I'm taking that history is I say, give me a picture. I start my history this way. Give me a picture of your mother and your father. You can start with either one. I'd like a picture of what they seem to you to be like in childhood, before adolescence. What do they look like? what's the personality like? I also want to know what they look like, because that often tells me something that falls outside of the person's self-scanning, and they're going to tell me things that I'll find out about the partner. So I'll ask first for a picture of mother and father, and then where do they fall in the sibling level, the sibling order, and then just to get a thumbnail sketch of how siblings are doing in their lives right now. And, you know, because if you've got a picture of mother and father as sort of Leave It to Beaver type people, and then one of the siblings is in prison, then you have a question that you want to ask about that a little bit more. But basically, going backwards in time, this relational history will very, very quickly, even the other person will see, she said exactly the same thing in her description of her mother as she said in her description of her husband and the problem in the current. She will even start to hear it. The images just come up from the story. And it's very powerful. So for someone, sometimes people don't notice it. Sometimes they even notice it themselves. But, you know, it'll be like, ah, sounds like mother, you know, affected you in this way. You felt this way with her. Interesting. You feel exactly that way with your husband.
So that might be alluded to, but we're not going to make a big deal of it yet. That'll become at the end of the session. But it's also very useful for the partner who's sitting listening to the partner go back over her life, let's say, from the present to the past, and without being able to interrupt.
And we call this an empathy interview because the interviewer, myself or Ed, will have empathy with the interviewee. And we will do various things to make the empathy come forward. Yes, it's really understandable that you would feel this way. Or sometimes also I'm a little bit challenging if somebody says some really negative things about a spouse and how difficult it's been, and then I might say, well, why did you stay with him? Why have you stayed with him then? I mean, things have been so difficult. Why do you choose to stay? So there are those kinds of things as we're moving along, making a story, trying to get a sense of this person's experience as it's been over time with relationships.
So after the one person is interviewed, we switch and do the whole thing again with the other partner. In this case, I would be interviewing the husband, and we would take our hour and do basically the same thing, the relational history starting in the present, going back to the past. By the end of that, we've got 2.5 hours into it, half an hour of the introductory stuff, and about an hour each with the interviews. And then we will take probably a half an hour to do partly a wrap-up, but more an explanation, which Polly does, of the family dynamics, the family of origin patterns that were internalized and are being played out in the current relationship.
And then each of us gives feedback to each of the people we've interviewed. We also tell them whether we think they're good candidates for dialogue therapy. We explain what dialogue therapy is. If they're not good candidates, we refer them somewhere in either some kind of treatment or a recovery or, you know, there are all sorts of things that we try to screen out. Like we try to screen out active addictions, certain kinds of personality disorders, and multiple betrayal, and physical abuse. Yeah. All of those things may need other kinds of treatment before dialogue therapy would be effective. We also try to give a prognosis, especially when there's been a lot of betrayal. If we feel that the prognosis is less than 50%, that we're actually going to succeed in helping the couple stay together, we'll say that. We'll say we're willing to work with you, but you need to know that your situation where there's been so much undermining of trust is really a difficult one to repair. And that in itself is a whole other discussion. But basically, working as dialogue therapists, if there has been a lot of undermining of trust, we have to address that before we can go into the dynamics. Because people don't even have the ability to believe each other.
One of the things that will happen at this point, usually, is that people, for the first time ever in their relationship, they have a map of their history. Going back to childhood, it's very broad, and they can see patterns which they were not aware of. So they can see how something's been going on under the surface in their relationship, both in their personal lives and in their interactions together, that have created or have worked to create this breakdown. And it's very, very helpful. It's actually essential that people can see that it makes sense. It's not like we're just incompatible or some disaster or some kind of vague theory they have about why this is really not going to work. They can see that it makes sense, and they can see that there's a way to heal it and help and improve. So hopefully, in most of the cases it's the case, that they leave that first session with a feeling of hope. It's very, very important that hope
be there. And even in the cases where the prognosis isn't good, when they see, you know, the woman that's sitting on the floor there, so you used this. I used this for projective identification. I just used this sort of sign. People get it right away. They get the feeling of being locked into each other's unconscious material and that it's so repetitive and it's really locked in. That's very helpful because they realize it's not just me personally. But here, people get locked into these things, and it's not just about my personality, but it's about also a condition that human beings are in when they're in intimate relationship.
This process working has really nothing whatsoever to do with level of education,
right,
even with psychological mindedness. People understand this. You don't have to have any psychology or
right,
any kind of interests or experience with these kinds of things. It just makes sense.
We've had so many, particularly men, who've been very hesitant to come, cops, airline pilots, men who just would never set their foot in the therapist's office, come reluctantly because their partners bring them. At the end of this first meeting, they're like cheerleaders. Boy, this was great. I can't believe it. You know, this wasn't what I thought it was going to be at all. And I mean, they're really upbeat. Even the ones that are clearly in trouble. It's been amazing to us how people take to this because suddenly things make sense to them and they actually have the sense of being validated, at least in their suffering makes some sense. And so
we actually have the opportunity for a kind of enlightenment here because when you have in spiritual tradition, the enlightenment experience, it does not come until you have spent years of effort practicing something and struggling with it and being very, very, very frustrated. So all of that's already there when the couple comes in the door. So the potential for insight is very big and very potentially very deep because they're suffering so greatly.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that the Dalai Lama says about suffering is that you obviously can't be enlightened unless you know you suffer. And couples know they suffer. They're really pretty good that way. Individuals often don't know that they create these difficulties for themselves. But, okay, yep. Yes, or if we suspect, you know, this is the way it usually goes.
We don't ask out of the blue, but sometimes you can tell. There's a little bit of something in the air when someone says something.
If you get the signal that this could be a possibility, I would never... If there's no indication of it, I would never bring up the subject. But if there are thousands of little signs that you can read. And then, of course, there are the direct accusations also. And we have a ton of stories of those kinds of things. But, again, this isn't the day to talk about them. The thing about affairs is, and this is on the sheet, they create separation anxiety. And even if... Say I'm the partner who's having an affair and I've never told my partner and maybe I've only had a very short affair, like a couple of nights in a hotel or something. But because I know I've had the affair, it's had an effect on our relationship. So hiding an affair is never really possible because the person who's had the affair knows, unless they're totally dissociated, that they've had the affair. And that creates separation anxiety. And so you can't actually really hide an affair. Can you put the window up a little bit, like one of those windows? Because I just think there's a little air in here. Let's assume then the assessment goes well and they're coming back for their first session of dialogue therapy. And you'll see a little demonstration of this. Chairs are set up in the same way. Every session of dialogue therapy starts out with the same thing, a dialogue or a conversation between the two people. Now, at the beginning of the second meeting, we'll ask them to talk about with each other what they'd like to accomplish in that meeting and however they want to talk about it. And then we'll guide them as it develops. The first thing that we're... We're not going to do it just yet. The first thing that we'll do is give them the rules of dialogue therapy, which is that basically we're going to act as alter egos and coaches, the two of us sitting outside their field of vision. Sometimes I'm going to speak as alter ego for the woman. Sometimes Ed will do that for the man. An alter ego is where I'm speaking as though I were the person, but I'm saying often what the person is implying but not saying directly. We say, you know, if we'll be speaking as though we were you, kind of moving in the direction that we would hope you to move. If we're not accurate, change it. If we're accurate, you can let it stand as though it were your voice, or you can make amendments to it. This is a modified use of doubling from psychodrama. And the other thing that we do is we lean forward and we coach the individual that we're working with. In a sense, I'm in a team with the woman and he is with the man, and I'm kind of coaching her to look at something or to pay attention to it. And I'm doing this from the point of view now of knowing the complexes from the first assessment. So I know her trigger points. Often, knowing the trigger points, I can actually feel in my body when she's triggered. I mean, because I'm sitting behind her slightly, and I'll just feel it. You know, you just sort of sense the trigger. And it's always, there are only about 5 variations of what can happen to couples. And so you very quickly can get the picture of what the individual is experiencing. In fact, it's so quick that sometimes it's frightening to people that we know so much about them without knowing them personally. And this, again, has to do with archetypes and complexes and that. So after we teach them a little bit about this, we also say we're going to ask you to paraphrase. We're going to stop you frequently and ask you to paraphrase. And we're going to ask you especially to paraphrase when you're thrown by what your partner has said. We're going to ask you to stop and say back what you understood the partner to be saying.
We also don't let couples fight. If there's someone's provoked and anyone becomes aggressive, we immediately stop it. And I might, as the double or as the coach for that person, talk to the person, say, "What is going on here?" And talk to me. Have the person talk to me to kind of talk that through. If it's a situation which cannot be kind of looked at or talked through in a minute, then I will switch chairs, let's say, with the wife, and I will talk to the husband in however long it takes to kind of talk through what's going on with him, what's been stirred up in him, so we can understand it, so he doesn't dump it into his partner. And then we work on it to the point where he understands enough, and then put the woman back in, and he picks up where he left off.
Right. So here are the rules of dialogue. They're on your sheet of paper. Ask questions rather than make assumptions or projections. So usually we start by encouraging people through our doubling to ask questions rather than make assumptions, and you'll see how that works on the video. Paraphrase and be sure you understand your partner before you answer with your own point of view. In an early session of dialogue therapy, we'll stop people constantly and say that back in your own words. Tell your partner how you're understanding this. And usually we have to press for that because it'll be, you know, in a moment where the person wants to discharge. So paraphrasing, saying back in your own words, and it doesn't mean just mimicking your partner, although some people cannot do more than mimic. They can only just say the exact words. So we try to work with the individual to see as much as possible to say it back in your own words, but if you can't, then just say back the words you heard. Then never attack, psychoanalyze, mind read, or aggress against your partner. And again, we work with this over and over again in the framework of
all the time, and we interrupt them and help them see that in the moment.
And it's ordinary life to do them. And so, and you're not, even if your intention is to rid yourself of aggression, you're not going to get rid of it easily. And then the final thing is to protect the relationship against your primitive emotions. And again, we will show people how to do this. We'll stop them. We'll tell them. We'll show them that this particular emotion is connected to emotional memory. And in this state, you feel like a child or a victim, but actually it's not your partner who has made you feel this way. And again, we come back to that because your partner doesn't make you feel like this. This state of feeling like a victim or a child is something that is going on in your own emotional memory. And generally, it's based on a fantasy of what's going on with your partner, not the reality. And as you recognize that, you begin to check out what's actually going on with you, partner. Help me understand, and often it's quite different from what the individual had assumed.
So we use a number of techniques to get at this and a number of kind of ways in. Insight into family of origin patterns and how those patterns are being unconsciously played out in the current situation. Also, behavioral modification. We just tell people what to say and how to act. We give a lot of advice. We do a lot of teaching. We do a lot of modeling. Sometimes when a couple is stuck in a situation, this just seems to be going around and around, and we haven't been able to make any headway, Polly will turn to me or I will turn to her and we'll say, look, it reminds me a little of what happened to us a couple of nights ago, which we haven't...
And then we'll play out the way you ask us to play it. We'll play out something with us that's actually real.
So they see how hard it is and how we're struggling with it too. And they watch us try to do these things, even though we're obviously having a lot of strong feelings and defensive and whatever it might be.
And when Ed says behavior modification, I would modify that a little to say we really don't do behavior modification. What we do is we sometimes tell people things that they can say in certain emotional states. For example, if you're very triggered and you don't know what to say, you can always say to your partner, help me understand why you feel that way, or help me see what you see. That is a little phrase, what I call a helpful hint.
Behavior modification has a connotation that I don't mean. I mean behavior training in terms of education is another way of saying it. There are certain things that if you do them, they help, and if you don't do them, they hurt. Certain other things, if you do them, they hurt. And people don't know this. So there's a fair amount of psychoeducation that goes with this.
Yeah, like psychoanalyzing your partner doesn't help. And a lot of people don't know that, particularly therapists. They think psychoanalyzing their partners will help, and it doesn't help. You can ask your partner, would you like to hear from me my version of what's going on with you and your mother, et cetera, or whatever? And then, you know, then take it from your partner. If the partner says, no, don't. But there was one other thing there. Oh, sex. Yeah, I just wanted to say something about sex. We had the handout. Some people were lucky enough to get it. The thing about sex that's really psychoeducational in this is that for some odd reason, many people do not know that female orgasm is connected to the clitoris. And I think it's so odd because there's so much information out there, but still there are many people, men and women, who believe that female orgasm is connected to the vagina. And the only reason why some women can have orgasm through intercourse is because the clitoris is close enough to the vagina that it's stimulated through intercourse. Now, that kind of information can be quite liberating to a couple where the woman has been ashamed that she hasn't been able to have orgasm through intercourse, and the man thinks there's something wrong with him that he hasn't been able to bring it about. And to find out that nobody has orgasm through intercourse because the vagina has no nerve endings in it is really good information. And so sometimes we put out some information like that when we get into the issues around sexual responses and sexual desire. Usually that's not in the first session of dialogue therapy. Often the very first thing is the anger versus aggression business, or it's the trust betrayal business. And then after people begin to see how to work with this, then usually the issues involving sex come up. And we will sometimes, particularly in regard to sex, we'll switch chairs and I'll interview the woman again and Ed will interview the man. Through these empathy interviews, we're trying to see their point of view and what it feels like to be them, because usually there's a lot of shame associated with sexual difficulty in a relationship. And there may be a lot of blame, too.
A lot of blame and a lot of pressure based on expectations of what sex is or what it's supposed to be, often based on watching movies.
Yeah, movies and novels and the muse and the romance and all of that. One other thing about female sexual desire that is, again, a great relief, that desire, as I said last night, is kind of the memory of pleasure. And people desire things when they've actually enjoyed them. If you really haven't enjoyed sex because you didn't really know how to have an orgasm or because it was painful or humiliating, why would you desire it? You know, there's no, you don't, there's not like, women don't have problems with sexual desire because there's something wrong with them. They have problems with sexual desire because it hasn't been fun. I mean, why would you want something if it had never been fun? So, you know, if it starts being fun, you start having desire. But, you know, so there's been so much confusion out there since the 19th century about female sexual desire that women and men are confused, and there's been a lot of kind of shame and blame. And then there's a lot of popular literature that says that women want to have intimacy in order to feel sexual, and men want to have sex in order to be intimate. And actually, intimacy is something that everybody really benefits from, and so is sexual pleasure. And if you actually have sexual pleasure, you can want sexual pleasure. You don't have to have intimacy as a way to get to sexual pleasure. You have intimacy as a groundwork, and sexual pleasure then is something that is like having a good dessert or something. You just want to have it because it's fun to have. But to get to that point means clearing away a lot of shame and guilt.
When a relationship is not good, sex seems really important. When a relationship is going well, sex is relatively unimportant. It's a relatively small thing. And with regard to these six sessions, obviously we can't solve all the problems in six sessions, but the problems are a life's worth of work. What happens when things go well, and they usually do, is that over the course of 4 to 5 to 6 sessions, people have the experience of the pleasure associated with doing things differently and the comfort and the closeness. They don't have it always, but they have glimpses of it. They have glimpses of this intimacy that was a potential.
Eventually became still an angry woman, but not enraged, and really pretty understanding of her anger, and the confused guy who came with her. That's more of the couple that we see now. And then the other thing is that it seems over time that there's been this shift which is towards a kind of moral superiority in women that I think is a problem, where women come in and feel that they're kind of on morally superior ground regarding relationship, that women have figured it out and men haven't. And I think that that's a problem that we've seen more in the late 90s towards now. So there are those kinds of things. Individual therapy, yeah. Because really, it's an individual issue whether you want to stay in your relationship or not. That's not a couple's issue.
There's so many issues. I know you've had your hand up for a while. We'll take that one more question, but then we're going to have to get to these because we're going to have to go a little past 3 o'clock.
Is that all right, or do they... let's say if we go to 3:15, and we will definitely leave at 3:15. Yeah, we'll definitely leave at 3:15. 3:15, we'll definitely leave. We're like long day's journey into night kind of people when we come to...
If we have to stay for questions until 3:30, would that be okay?
No, that's not it.
I'd rather not, but, you know, these videos themselves take 25 minutes.
Oh.
We don't have any time for questions.
All right. Well, why don't we let them decide what they would? Would you rather see the videos or do you want to see the videos?
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely
then we will take whatever remains for questions until 4:15. Okay. Then one more question now. You'll wait. Okay. Let's show the videos.
This is a couple that we saw many years ago. You'll see we're a lot younger. I had hair.
We have a lot of hair. I had long hair. You had a lot of hair.
That's the most important thing. Right.
We used to have hair.
This is a couple we're doing a couple's workshop. This is in California.
San Diego.
Well, I wasn't going to say.
Oh. In case anyone knows anyone in San Diego.
If you do, be quiet. This is a volunteer couple that have volunteered to talk about their relationship and some of their problems for demonstration purposes. They've agreed to let us use this videotape as long as we didn't use it within 50 miles of their geographical area.
There are
100 people in the audience watching this.
But this was not a training in dialogue therapy.
No.
This was just an introduction and a demonstration, but not a training.
What you'll see here is about 20 minutes into the first, all we did was a first
assessment
session. And this starts about 20 minutes in. What they've done so far is they've talked about what they want to accomplish and what they think are the problems. The man said that the problem, as far as he's concerned, is money. And that he feels she goes out from the money problem. He's a saver, and he sees her as a spender. I think that's enough.
And they had agreed, supposedly, to talk about this in a public domain, that they weren't going to reveal more than that.
Later on in the session, when asked, is there anything other than money, he said, yes, sex is a problem. And it says that sex, she doles it out. When he gives her money or when he acts nice and money, whatever, then she will have sex. And so that's another problem as he sees it, as he saw it. And the woman...
Where are we coming in on this?
Coming in after they've had their initial back and forth, and you're starting to interview her to explore what she was saying. I think all she said prior to this was that she wants to see the real you. She wants him to be able to take in her reality, and she wants to see who he really is underneath all of whatever. Polly is interviewing a woman, and you will see the... I love this particular passage. It's about 10 to 12 minutes long, where she's having trouble kind of really admitting how she feels to herself. And Polly helps her to do it, and it just starts to take off. And after we do that, we will show you scene from the very end where we have them talking to one another, and we're reacting as doubles to help them have a double.
So you see a little empathy interview, you see a little bit of the doubling and a little bit of mixing and matching of stuff. And also, I like to say, remember, it's California, because they've recently been to Harville Hendrix's workshop. So this is a sort of workshop place, California.
I felt something come up in response to what you and Ed talked about. And I like the way you really quickly got that there were other and deeper things that were on my mind. And money is also.
About 10 minutes, because she and I talk about her sexuality. And it would just bring up another level of issue. We have about 10 minutes until quarter after. Not quite. I mean, maybe, yeah, about 10 minutes, right? So, what else do you want to know or say? Whatever, yes. Yes, yes, people do use it. Yes, yes, people use it all the time like that. I don't think it's as good, but... Ed does use it himself, and
it's not as good, but it's good. It's not as good. You don't have two therapists. You can't beat a foursome with a therapist couple and another. But individuals can do it. There are different variations of what you can do. I've tried it, literally getting up in the room, straightening up, and standing behind somebody and doing a double nothing to do, and kind of being a standing therapist and walking sometimes back and the other one doing a doubling that way. But what I do now. As I sit in the chair, they're having a conversation, I will sort of tilt my head over towards one person and say what I might have them say if I were them, which they can accept or not. And they kind of get it. And so you don't really have to sit in back of the person. It's more suggesting. And gradually people kind of learn that if I'm like this, I'm kind of doubling the man over here. If I'm in this direction, I'm doubling her. The doubling technique is the most powerful technique because it's active in the moment. It's not talking about something that happened a minute ago. It's an active thing that they can practice. And practice is a very, very big part of this because it needs to be practiced. It's like anything you're going to get good at. You can't just understand it by hearing someone talk about it. You have to practice it and see what it feels like and see how difficult it is in the moment as you're doing it. So all those things can be done by a therapist, by herself or himself.
It goes without saying that one of the problems with one therapist in a couple is triangulation. And many times a couple will try to triangulate a therapist, and number of therapists that I supervise who do couples therapy, I think they get into trouble because they're unknowingly triangulated into the couple's relationship. Then the couple relies on them, on the therapist, to actually interact. So the thing that happens when you've got two therapists is you get around that as a problem, actually. It's set up so that you can't be triangulated because there are two dyads. Tavistock in London uses two dyads also, largely their marital therapy does. So it's the ideal, but it costs more money. It takes more scheduling.
You don't always have a therapist that you can work with.
Yeah, and you have to have a
certain amount of obvious compatibility.
Yeah, and a long time to practice together with your dyadic partner. Every session, actually, we always start it with the couple talking about what they want to deal with in the session. Sometimes there's carryover. Sometimes we ask them to talk additionally about something that they were supposed to have encountered in the interim. Like we'll say, the last time you were here. I mean, one of the things about couples therapy, by the way, in terms of the research, it's the least successful form of therapy. And one reason why people feel it's unsuccessful is that the consumers feel that the therapists don't carry over enough and don't keep up with what's going on with a couple. So just in terms of the notes that we take, and we try to begin the meeting even a month later by somehow referring back in some way. If we don't ask them to refer back, we will refer back in our dialogue with each other. So every session opens with their interchange, then we do what we call an assessment with each other, and then we decide what we're going to do in the session. And we do use other techniques, and there are certain characteristics to the first session, which is the assessment, then the second, the fourth, and the sixth. So when we do training, we act as though we're having those sessions on the training days that we would be here to do the training. So there are things that characterize the sessions, but they're not themes that we introduce. They're more like dynamics.
Research on outcomes of marital therapy.
I'm responding particularly from the Consumer Report study. That was a self-report study, the largest study of psychotherapy ever done. And the lowest ranking form of therapy was couples therapy. And the least sort of what was considered by the consumer, the least effective of the therapists were marital therapists. My sense is it's because the work is so challenging and so few people really do understand what to do with this particular kind of intervention, which is an intervention on a dynamic field that is already swamped with unconscious material by the first time. You can't just say, we're going to meet next week and talk about this again. It doesn't work for the couple. So I'm speaking really from the Consumer Report study, but there have been other meta-analyses that show sort of the same. I don't think really more self-report than so-called outcome studies. In yourself, it's the focus of any kind of therapy, is to identify your own trigger points, your own internal states, and so on, with the idea that when you know them, you can become freer of them. Not that you become completely free of them, but they don't dominate your life. You can become aware. Then you have a freedom not to enact that, not to treat it as though it's reality. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I want to just emphasize, and I know Ed probably has his way of answering this, but my sense is that in all of our modeling and everything we do, what we try to do is to show how to hold this space open. Not to enact, but to hold open a space, not to foreclose on meaning, not to think you know in advance what this means, but to stay open to the discovery of something new. That's all that we show in all these different things that we do, but we do try to show kind of helpful hints of what you can do to do that.
Why would you think I wouldn't agree with that?
Oh, I didn't know.
Oh, yeah.
I thought you were looking like you might have a different answer.
No, you're misinterpreting my whatever.
Okay.
No, I was just thinking about her question, that I totally agree with that in terms of what we model I was thinking of basically when you look at how therapists with different orientations use different ways of interpreting what's going on. Like a cognitive behavioral therapist might look at the automatic or the unconscious or the irrational thoughts that are going on that are part of why you're reacting the way you're reacting. That psychoanalytic Jungian types would look at the parental complexes that are being triggered. It doesn't really matter what you're using. I think it's very, very difficult to work with couples if you don't have an understanding of an explanation through the unconscious, because there's so much unconsciousness operating. If you don't have some way to see how you are participating in an unconscious enactment, it's very difficult to get to what's under the surface. But talking about it, looking at it, taking it out of the darkness and saying, this is how I think things are happening. What do you think? This is how I see what's going on in relationship to your family of origin. Putting it out there, working with people to see if they can, if it makes sense to them, and fine-tuning it so that it does make sense. At some point they can get it. And then helping them in the moment sort of notice how they are projecting this onto their partner. For being able to see that you react to them out of this expectation, and actually you know that it wasn't that way. To sort of help people see this discrepancy between what they imagine is going on and what seems to be actually going on. So it's a matter of capturing that in the moment as it's happening.
Right, right.
So it's one thing to name it, but then the process of working through, I guess you could call it, is capturing it as you see people enacting it in subsequent sessions.
Also, you know, all forms of therapy, there are many common curative factors in all forms of therapy, but all forms of therapy try to, this is the way I say it, they try to get the devil into the room. You know, dynamic therapy really did begin with exorcism to some extent. And you could not just go to your exorcist and say, look, I'm having a problem with the devil. You had to actually be possessed in order to be helped. And so all these forms of therapy, in one way or another, try to get the devil into the room, bring the whole family in, or, you know, get the couple to interact, or get into the transference. Whatever it is to get that into the room. Once it's in the room, then you have the option of working on it. But before that, you're just talking about it.
You can't see it, you know, until it's in the room. That's why couples therapy has so much potential to help people so quickly. Whereas individual therapy takes a very long time, because in order to develop, as Polly alluded to earlier, to develop that where the devil comes into the room, it can take years of developing a relationship with a therapist and a lot of frustration and a lot of effort so that frustration and that trust is there so that frustration can be expressed and you can actually do that projecting. Whereas a couple will do that projecting at the very first session.
Now, of course, people who have certain kinds of personality disorders will do that from the beginning with the therapist as well in individual therapy. But that also can create a problem because there's no therapeutic.
You know that it wasn't that way. To sort of help people see this discrepancy between what they imagine is going on and what seems to be actually going on. So it's a matter of capturing that in the moment as it's happening.
Right, right.
So it's one thing to name it, but then the process of working through, I guess you could call it, is capturing it as you see people enacting it in subsequent sessions.
Also, you know, all forms of therapy, there are many common curative factors in all forms of therapy, but all forms of therapy try to, this is the way I say it, they try to get the devil into the room. You know, dynamic therapy really did begin with exorcism to some extent. And you could not just go to your exorcist and say, look, I'm having a problem with the devil. You had to actually be possessed in order to be helped. And so all these forms of therapy, in one way or another, try to get the devil into the room, bring the whole family in, or, you know, get the couple to interact, or get into the transference. Whatever it is to get that into the room. Once it's in the room, then you have the option of working on it. But before that, you're just talking about it.
You can't see it, you know, until it's in the room. That's why couples therapy has so much potential to help people so quickly. Whereas individual therapy takes a very long time. Because in order to develop, as Polly alluded to earlier, to develop that where the devil comes into the room, it can take years of developing a relationship with your therapist and a lot of frustration and a lot of effort, so that frustration and that trust is there, so that that frustration can be expressed and you can actually do that projecting. Whereas a couple will do that projecting at the very first session.
Now, of course, people who have certain kinds of personality disorders will do that from the beginning with the therapist as well in individual therapy. But that also can create a problem because there's no therapeutic alliance then. You know. Did that answer your question? Did we answer it together? And... Right. And one other little tiny thing, because it has to do with meditation in a way that, and I know you have a background in that, that, you know, when a state comes up in meditation, at least in most of the forms of Buddhist meditation, you neither condemn it nor do you identify with it, but you hold it. In a sense, you hold it, hopefully, with some equanimity. So this is the same thing we're teaching. We're teaching that when you're triggered and you see, you know, you have some experience of feeling victimized or whatever, not to condemn that. For one thing, people, once they start seeing their patterns, they'll say, basically, I'm a terrible person, you know, I do these things. So you don't condemn it, and you don't identify with it, but you notice it. If you notice it with equanimity, you open up a space around it, you have other choices. It's very similar to a meditative practice in that way. And I believe that all forms of psychotherapy are headed towards that same goal, of neither to condemn nor identify with these states. Frequency. We do. Sometimes we do as long as we'll do 12. We have a way of extending the frequency. Yes, that's right. Frequency. I'm thinking you don't mean to shrink the time between, more than six. We do not deal with people who are separating, who are actively separating. Usually when the couple comes in, we do the evaluation. If one person is saying, I really don't think I want this relationship anymore, we usually refer out to individual therapy because that's an individual issue. The question of whether you want the relationship is your own individual issue. Nobody can tell you as a couple whether you should stay in this relationship. But if there is a lot of betrayal, that's usually the reason why we might meet for 12 meetings, because first we have to deal with the betrayal. And that may be a different question. We don't see people in any shorter interims than the month.
If a couple comes in, for instance, and as long as they both want the relationship, even if they're in a terrible, terrible mess, we will generally see them as long as they both say they want to work on this. Now,
unless there's an active addiction, we refer them
really
for that. Or something interferes with that.
The other point. So, what we would do if, rather than see them every week, which we don't do, we would refer them very strongly into individual therapy concurrent with the couples therapy if they're not already in.
Right.
That would be their support. That would be where they go to check in.
Exactly. And the individual therapy is really focused on the individual. We say to them, we're focused on the couple. It's a third element between the two of you. That's our focus.
Okay. I think it's time to say
thank
goodbye.
You. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.